Welcome to the premiere episode of Movie Challenge Accepted. I'm Jason.
I am Marco.
And every week, we're going to come here and discuss a couple of movies that we probably would not have watched on our own unless we didn't have this podcast and we weren't really being forced. We have different ideas on what movies are quality, don't we?
I definitely agree that we don't agree in a lot of movies, and these are definitely not two movies that either one of us would have watched if we did not challenge each other on it.
Your idea behind this podcast was to force me to watch Marvel movies and Fast and Furious movies and other stuff that I would not normally see. My idea was to force you to watch foreign films that you probably haven't seen.
Exactly. We joke around a lot about the movies that we like and how you think that the movies I like are shit and how they've ruined Hollywood, really, or the movie experience for people like yourself. So I believe that films should be fun and that we shouldn't get too deep in a lot of it. And you feel otherwise. So this has been a perfect opportunity for us to see the other side of movies that we normally wouldn't see.
Right. So what were the movies we chose for each other for this, our premiere episode?
So for you, I chose Fast and the Furious 5, which is a kind of a weird selection, people have told me, but I don't think so, as it was clearly the most popular film in the franchise and marked a point where the franchise made a turn into truly blockbuster status with the addition of The Rock to the franchise.
Yeah, the Rock. Yeah, I've got thoughts on him in this movie.
I'm sure you do.
And for you, I forced you to watch Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky's sci-fi existential three-hour drama Solaris.
It was definitely forcing, and I did tell you it was a bit of a slog, but I have some very nice thoughts for you on the film also. So I think that you're going to be happy with what I have to say.
Right. Like, I think we should tell everyone who's listening and the many thousands of people who are listening. The idea here is that we're not coming to each other's movies to shit on them. Right?
No, I think we're not going to do that.
Right. I think the idea is that we're each ideally going to be opened up to other kinds of forms of entertainment that maybe we might look down on otherwise, or we might not be interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I never even heard of. I've heard of the remake of Solaris, but I did not know. I didn't know it was a remake, to be quite honest with you. So this is a movie that I would never have seen, gone out of my way to see. So this has been eye opening.
See, so all right. So already, this project is a success.
Yeah, to say the least.
All right. So we were discussing before we came on the air, before we started recording, we were discussing which movie we should do first. And I think in order to retain listenership, we should probably lean into the movie that most people have seen.
Yes.
Which is Justin Lin's 2011 Fast Five. It is the fifth. Right? Am I right? I'm guessing because of the name?
Fifth one. Yes, definitely. That's how it goes.
All right. So this is the fifth in the franchise, which is up to, I think, 47 films now, if I'm right.
It seems like it. It seems like the kids in the movies are that were just born are now going to be driving along with their parents. But yes, up to number nine.
For anyone listening, I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie before last night. Not one.
And you have told me in the past that you would never see it. Or you would never see one.
I have no interest in it, but right. I didn't have any interest in it. I noticed that what I was drawn to, the positives that I thought in the movie, kind of reminded me, in the movie in its best parts, reminded me of the best James Bond movies.
Okay.
And specifically with this one. So, okay, for anyone that doesn't know, and I'm sure you're probably not here if you have not seen Fast Five, This is the one where Paul Walker, Brian O'Connor, is, I guess he's now no longer a Fed. Right?
Yeah. Yes. So a really quick recap. In the first movie, he was an undercover police officer tasked to break into Dominic Toretto / Vin Diesel's gang of carjackers. After that movie.
Wait, so they were car. So hang on. In the first movie, they were carjackers?
Yes, they were carjackers, and this is so really quick recap. Vin Diesel's gang was, you know, a family, which is something that you'll learn if you ever watch any other movies. Family of friends who got into trouble, and they decided that they're going to start carjacking, basically trucks on the highway, and steal, which was back at the time very expensive equipment like DVD players, high-end stereos, and things like that. So the cops wanted to make sure that the truckers didn't take the law into their own hands and start shooting up these people that were attacking them. So they sent in Paul Walker to try and infiltrate and get as much info on them as possible.
So that was the plot. That was the original plot of the first movie.
Yes, the original plot of the first movie. At the end, Paul Walker lets Vin Diesel go. And for that, he gets kicked out of the force. And I don't know how it works that you're kicked out of being in the force, but by the fourth movie, he is now an FBI agent. So I don't know how that – yeah.
So I'm going to say that, like, traditional logic in the real world, right. I think if I had to let go of it.
Yes, you do.
But if you let go of it, it can be fun. My issue, like, for instance, and jump into the end of Fast Five. Well, I started this off, I was talking about how in the best ways it could be almost like a Bond movie. And I say that because Rio, the shots of Rio, the favelas, the beaches.
Very well done.
Really well done. Like, it had a sense of place. And right. Sort of that South American, specifically Brazilian vibe, I think kind of came through in a way I didn't expect. Because, you know, there's so many great scenes in all the Bond movies of him in Vienna and Berlin and Macau and
Cuba
in No Time to Die, right. Jamaica at one point. But you always get a great sense of place. And there was a sense of globe hopping. And I was kind of impressed at sort of the scale and the ability of Justin Lin, the director, to make me feel like I was in Rio.
Nice. Very nice.
Right. Okay. But then people started talking and characters said dialogue that I assume, like, I guess. All right. Number one, here's my big question. What kind of throat cancer does Vin Diesel have, and is he going to be okay?
He does not have throat cancer. It is just the fact that that's how he sounds because he is awesome. And as we followed his career from Private Ryan all the way to the last Fast movie, this is what he sounds like. And he makes no apologies for it, and people still keep on giving him roles. So he must be doing something right.
So I'm looking at Vin's IMDb right now, and he has, according to IMDb, he has 37 credits as an actor in a movie. And the third credit, 1998, he was Private Carpazzo in Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
Great movie.
Great movie.
And he was pretty good in it.
He was, although, you know, when he hit big, I had to be reminded that he was in Saving Private Ryan, as I'm sure many people had to be reminded of that, because his character was, well, he was the throwaway character. He was eliminated by midway in that film, and I forgot that he was in it until many years later.
Yeah. And then he's in Boiler Room.
Great film.
Yeah. Pretty. I give you that. Pretty good movie. And then he gets into Pitch Black, and then in 2000 he does Pitch Black, and in 2001 he does Fast and the Furious, and then after that, it's mostly, excluding Triple X, which I'd never seen. Are you going to make me watch that?
I'm not going to make you watch that because I did not like that film either.
Okay, cool. After 2000, Chronicles of Renicus 2004. It's mostly Fast and the Furious, and then, of course, he becomes Groot in Guardians. Mm-hmm. But his career now is mostly Fast and Furious movies.
Yes, he is Dominic Toretto. That's who he is.
And so I didn't even realize that he's not in the second... hang on. He's not in Too Fast, Too Furious.
Right.
That is Paul Walker and Tyrese.
Right.
He's not in Tokyo Drift, and Tokyo Drift doesn't even have Paul Walker in it.
No. Well, let me give you a really quick recap on this. And this is unfortunately the downside of you, of me giving you the fifth movie to jump into. You really don't have something to look back on and say, okay, I remember this character, I remember this story. He gave up on the Fast and the Furious franchise after the first one. He went in to do Triple X, and he decided that that's the way he was going to go. So the studio that did Fast and the Furious, I don't know who it is, to be quite honest with you, decided that they were going to move forward without him. And they did the second one, which was received well, but didn't do as well as the first. And the third one, Tokyo Drift, did poorly considering where it had started from. However, at the end of Tokyo Drift, Vin Diesel does show up and he has a race against the protagonist of that film, Lucas Black. What happened was he had said he would do a cameo, a 10-second cameo, if he was allowed to have the rights to the Riddick character, which he loved. He loved the Riddick character.
So Vin Diesel's passion project is the Shakespearean creation that is Riddick.
Absolutely. The first film was horror. The second film was much more science fiction based, and the third one sort of went back to the horror aspect of it, but that was his passion project. He lives and dies by Riddick almost as much as he does Dominic Toretto.
Okay.
So for those 10 seconds that he was filmed, the studio gave him the rights to Riddick, and he now owns it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then afterwards, when it was surprisingly in 2008 or 2009, they came out with Fast and Furious, which is the fourth one. And it really was a surprise that they came back with it because everybody had thought the franchise was forgotten after the third one. And it pretty much was. They brought it back, brought him back. And that's really when this storyline of family started. And pretty much everybody from that point on has had cameos or big parts in the upcoming movies.
Yeah, I definitely noticed, and I'd been aware, like just through the pop culture sort of zeitgeist, like I'd been aware of the concept of family running through the Fast and the Furious movies, and I've heard podcasts, you know, discussing these movies, even though I've never seen the movies, which is weird, but whatever. But yeah, I've gotten that, like the whole idea of family is huge within these movies. And
yes.
There's not a lot of subtlety in terms of beating that concept over the head. Like in Fast Five, Paul Walker and Vin Diesel are sitting out on that balcony in Brazil. And right. Paul's asking, you know, what he remembers of his father. And Vin tells that story about how he would have these cookouts after church for everyone in the neighborhood. And if you didn't go to church, you couldn't come to the barbecue.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So like they do a good job of saying like, hey, this is the emotional thread that you need to grab hold of that's going to pull you through these movies.
And that was all fine and dandy. While I do love these movies, you know, I understand that there is some silliness to them, of course. But, you know, being that I want them to be fun, I do love these movies. However, when you say subtlety about the family part of it, at no point any longer is there any subtlety. They have drinking games now that college kids drink every time they say the word family in these movies. So that's how blunt it has become.
Yeah. And that's why you have a lot of drunk college kids, because they're playing exactly. Drinking games where every time Dominic says, family.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah. My wife came down for like the last 30 minutes of this movie. No, it was before the vault heist, so maybe like the last 45 minutes.
She stare at you?
No, she actually met Vin Diesel once, and she said he's very short. So
yeah, he is short. Yeah.
Very short guy, but she said, "What's wrong with his voice?" So I didn't tell her in advance, like, hey, I think Vin Diesel's got throat cancer. We need to do something. She came down, never having seen one of these movies. She heard Vin say one line of dialogue, and she's like, hey, what's wrong with him? And, you know, there's kind of like a very, there's a way that these characters have to sort of identify themselves, and the way the director and the writer, I think Chris Morgan is the writer.
Right.
That they have to sort of identify these characters because there's so many of them. And the movie's 2 hours and 10 minutes long. And by the way, 8 minutes of that is credits.
Yes.
They have to implant these characters in your mind very quickly. And you know straight away that Tyrese is the lady killer.
Right. Jokester also.
Yep. Although I thought, in all honesty, I thought he was that character, Roman. Roman's the character's name.
Yeah, Roman.
I thought Roman's insufferable. He
gets worse.
Oh, he gets worse? Oh, my God.
It's worse. It really is. It's almost like a shrieking whine that he has. And keep on going, because I know where you're going with this, but I'll add to it when you're done. Go ahead.
Okay, so Tej, Ludacris. I liked that character a lot. And okay. I was surprised that he was sort of the understated, quiet character, because he's Luda. But
yes, exactly.
They bring Luda down to like a five, and he's entertaining. And then of course hang on.
It's okay. It's all right. I don't know all the names of the actors unless they're Gal Gadot, of course.
Right. So Leo and Santos are played by Tego Calderon and Don Omar, who are two they're two reggaeton Spanish music stars, and they're
and
obviously
Don Omar. Also sings the song, as I'm talking about it, sings the song. Help me out here.
What that plays over the closing credits?
Yes, at the end. That's him.
That's Don Omar.
That's Don Omar, and of course that's a very famous song. That Danza Goduro. There you go.
I was unfamiliar.
Yeah, famous to everybody but you. Okay, go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of things that are famous to everything but me. And okay. you get these characters right away where you're like, hey, these two are the guys that love each other, but they're also constantly breaking each other's balls. And
like a family.
Like a family. And Giselle is the very confident, very beautiful. I don't know how to even describe her, because they're not really... Here's my thing. They're not fully formed characters, okay? Outside of Dominic and maybe Mia, everyone else gets sort of like a line or two, a throwaway line or sort of a throwaway behavior, where you're just supposed to accept that when Dominic says, we need a chameleon, and Han, played by Sung Kang, he shows up. What about him as a chameleon? What does he do in the movie that affirms that statement that Dominic says we need a chameleon?
Well, I mean, the beach scene when he's with Giselle, he's basically in the background, so maybe he's not noticeable. Maybe that's what he means. The chameleon kind of blends into the background.
Yeah, but he brings
and he's not noticeable.
He brings nothing to the table. They could
the only thing he did was eat. If you notice, that's all he was doing in the film.
He ate, and at the end of the movie, he drives away down the Autobahn with Giselle in his lap in probably a fairly unsafe method of driving.
I wouldn't do that. No,
very dangerous. But yeah, that's essentially what he brings to the table. Like Luda, at least you get, he's okay. That's the tech guy. He's like the Q of this, of this series. And Roman Roman's the guy who's able to sort of cajole women and also guys, and also
talk his way out of anything. Yeah.
Somehow able to convince a Brazilian police officer to take a box and put it into the vault where they're keeping all the evidence without looking
where
in it.
Needs to be. Yeah, where it needs to be.
After the cop identifies that the FBI credentials, Roman Flash has identify him as a Caucasian, which, guess what? I was, for those of you that don't know, I was a New York City police detective for 20 years, and I was also on a federal task force. I never had credentials that identified me as a white dude. It doesn't say anywhere on my ID card, like, this guy's white. But again, on the FBI credentials, it says, you're Caucasian. Roman says, that's whatever. Here, take this box.
And it worked. And look, he flashed a smile, and the guy was won over.
I feel like this takes the concepts of some of the creative ways of finding out information that are common in the Bond films, and this sort of dumbs it down. I mean, Listen, I'm okay. I'm okay with a dumb, wacky action movie.
Right.
But I almost felt at times that this was kind of offensive to me.
To you, I would imagine that being spoon-fed the information that you, so you didn't have to think any harder or any more about it, would probably be offensive. To me, all right, that explains that. Move on to the next scene. Yeah, there are many times where you sit back and you're like, oh, man, that was really dumb. But, all right, one or two scenes like that to make the overall experience fun is okay.
And I would go along with that, except for this.
Okay.
So as explanatory as the movie is in terms of every character saying, this is what we're doing right now, and then if there was any chance that the audience wouldn't figure out what the plan is, there's another character there to say exactly what's going on. There's very little left. There's very few pieces left for the audience to sort of connect the dots on their own. It's all laid out for them. But having said that...
It's not subtle. It's not subtle. You're right.
It's not subtle. But having said that, I'm a little confused about a couple things. So... The bad guy, played by, let me see, Joaquin Almeida, who I've seen in other projects.
Oh, yeah. Bad guy, the heavy in Desperado.
Oh, that's right. He was.
Absolutely. And he was in, I believe he was in Clear and Present Danger with Harrison Ford. Because he's definitely a 90s face in the movies that you would remember.
He was in Clear and Present Danger. He was in Behind Enemy Lines, and he was in Desperado.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's definitely one of those faces that you've seen 1,000 times.
Yeah, right. So when I saw him in this, I'm like, "Whoa, what's he been doing?"
Yeah, but unfortunately he doesn't. I don't think he's given enough to do. But
no, he's just a face.
He's a face, and he's supposed to be threatening, but also the bad guy. See, so this is the other thing: is that the bad guys. You need a bad guy in a movie like this. And again, I keep referring to the Bond movies because I feel like the Bond movies are the best example of this kind of big, stupid action movie. You take a bad guy like Raul Silva, played by Javier Bardem in Skyfall, and he is menacing. And so you fear for Daniel Craig's James Bond because Javier Bardem knows what he's doing, and you get the impression that he's a match for Bond.
And I think that Javier Bardem's character is able to kill in many different ways and ruin you in many different ways, and also with his hands. So he can do the dirty work also, and not afraid to do that. Whereas the character in Fast and the Furious, like you're saying, is kind of menacing, but he lets other people do the work for him.
And everyone that he has doing the work for him is incompetent because they all...
Totally incompetent.
All the bad guys essentially become Star Trek red shirts where they're all wearing masks. You know what this reminded me of? Did you ever play Call of Duty? I forget which one it was. There was one of the Call of Duties where there was a huge scene in the favelas.
I've never played a Call of Duty game. I'm sorry.
What?
I know people are going to be crazy about that as a gamer, as big of a gamer I am, but I do not enjoy the Call of Duty games because I don't like the online aspect of it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there was, I forget which Call of Duty it was, maybe Modern Warfare. I haven't played any of these in like 7 years, but there was a Call of Duty game where there was a mission where you had to find a guy in the favelas and extract him. And I don't know which came first. I don't know if this movie came first and Call of Duty leaned into this movie, but all the scenes, all the action scenes in the favelas, I thought were great because the favelas are inherently cinematic, you know, sort of the vertical nature of it and the kind of the rundown, very claustrophobic alleys. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that kind of creates tension.
But, they film well.
Yeah. Like, hey, listen, it's cool to look at. The vault chase, when you finally get to it, I thought was really inventive. Like, I couldn't look away.
Right, exactly. I mean, as silly as something like that could be. I mean, honestly, I'm a smart person. I'm not a dumb person, but I don't understand the physics behind something like that actually working.
There are
but
none.
They made it work, and they made it work on film, so they made it look good. And I could not look away either. For those 10 minutes of that chase through the streets of Rio, it was incredible.
Yeah, I thought that was actually pretty well done. But I had less of a problem with the irrational, impossible physics of that vault chase than I did with the opening train robbery when they're just dropping like a Ford GT40 3 feet off of a flatbed, and the car's totally fine in the middle of the desert. Oh yeah, or whatever.
Basically, as soon as it hits the ground, it hits the ground running, and it goes in reverse or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had some issues with that, but here was the other thing. The other thing I was saying about the bad guys. So again, not to lean on the Bond movies, but guess what? I'm leaning on the Bond movies.
It's okay.
Not only is Reyes not all that compelling or frightening as a bad guy, but his main henchman, ZZ, played by Michael Irby,
right,
is a non-factor. Mm-hmm. And so what you're left with, Hobbs becomes the bad guy, right?
Yes.
Essentially the antagonist for most of the movie.
It's Hobbs and the money, really, that's all that Dominic Toretto and his gang are worried about.
Right, but they need to. You need like an emotional face. You need a face to latch on to emotionally if you're gonna care about Dominic and Brian and Mia and the whole family, and you're gonna say, "Oh man, I hope they get out of this." You need to be worried about someone on the other side. And once Hobbs is removed as that threat and he sort of flips, that was another pretty effective scene. The ambush on Hobbs. Yeah. I thought that was actually pretty well done when his whole team gets wiped out.
Yeah. I didn't see that coming when I first saw it. So I definitely felt something there and I thought it was well done.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty well done too. But once you remove Hobbs as a bad guy and you no longer have him saying lines like, I quote, "Make sure you're wearing your Thunderwear." They've made 11 of these movies.
And a Hobbs spinoff also. And it doesn't get any better via dialogue, okay? It really doesn't.
But I guess that's the thing, right? Is I haven't watched any of these. They make a bajillion dollars.
They do.
Clearly, there's a market and people enjoy them and they make money and they're successful and clearly the actors like being a part of it and so they keep coming back.
Right, right. I blame the Transformers that they're able to make such silly, incredibly inane movies, make billions of dollars, whether it's here in America or overseas. And until they get to that really one bad one that breaks the back, they're going to keep on doing it.
Well, just to show, like, I don't really read reviews of movies before I see them anymore, right, because I don't want to have my mindset affected, so I don't read reviews. But right, I looked this up on Metacritic, and it has a 66 on the Metascore. Metacritic is like an aggregation of all different critical reviews for movies and TVs and TV shows. And
66 is not bad.
66 out of 100, much better than I thought. 29 positive reviews, 10 mixed, 2 negative. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times, what he said was, "What it all comes down to is a skillfully assembled 130 minutes at the movies with actors capable of doing absurd things with straight faces and action sequences that toy idly with the laws of physics."
Oh, boy. And this was 2011.
And he liked it. He liked it. He gave, I can't read the full review, but this is the blurb from Metacritic, and they listed as a 75, so probably a 3 stars from him. Right. And I have to sit here and say, listen, a lot of people like these movies. So there's something I wasn't getting, or I maybe still don't get. But having seen one now, I think I understand the appeal. Especially probably in a big on a big screen in a movie theater with a great sound system, I could see how this is a good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you've seen all of these.
I have not seen the last one. I mean, and by the way, we didn't give a spoiler alert, but spoiler alert on the last one. I know that the cars go into space.
What? Wait, F9.
Nine. Previous to that, they've had cars in the Arctic Circle going up against a nuclear submarine. They've had jetpacks put on the cars They're going through the streets of London. So to your point where when you were talking about each person has their role in the group, it's basically the beginning of their superhero group and what each of them can do. And Tej, you know, he's in the first movie that he was in, which was the second one, he was just an auto mechanic. He comes into this one and he plays Robin Hood because he's stealing money from ATMs and giving it away to people. He showed none of that in his first appearance. Roman Pierce was just a smooth talker, but now he's pumped up into, a Bond. Gal Gadot is a super spy in this film. Han, also super spy. So this is like the Avengers, but for car racing. And where it became car racing in the first few movies becomes a government-sponsored team, and I'm doing air quotes, that is used for clandestine missions around the world. And I shit you not, that is exactly what is happening.
All right, so that's what it sort of evolves to. So then that makes me think, for the listeners, the big beef in between Arco and I and another friend of ours has been my belief that the Marvel movies are a net negative for film going, for filmmaking.
Okay.
And so then I would ask you, is the Marvel superhero success of that model of kind of movie, do you think that has changed what the Fast and the Furious has to be in order to continue to be successful? Like, it's not enough to just have a story about guys illegally street racing.
I don't know that Marvel itself has influenced the direction of the Fast franchise. However, when you see some of the stunts, and I'm sure you could YouTube all the silly stuff, get a montage of it, all the stuff that they're doing after this particular movie, it really is striking. And you kind of wonder if you are correct, where, you know, you need to have these superhuman people doing these stunts and these feats for people to really be latch on to be invested in the movies. And for them to go up against submarines and space, and like, this started as street racing. Where did these guys become, government spooks all of a sudden?
Right. So then this kind of it leads us into exactly what this show is about. And I think you just said it. Right. Is what has happened where viewers and movie viewers and TV viewers, where they feel that every single piece of content they consume, every story we are willing to listen to or sit through and watch, has to consist of some sort of superhero component. Everything has to be over the top. And my fear, in before we sort of came up with this idea, my belief was that it's very difficult to get a lot of people to invest in a quiet, emotional, well-told, grounded story. And I feel as though we've almost been conditioned where everything has to be bigger. Every movie has to be bigger than the one that came before it. And that's why another show that you and I have talked about a lot, Game of Thrones. As Game of Thrones grew, the quality went down.
It became weaker story-wise. Absolutely. Like grandiose sets, bigger explosions, the bigger CGI. I mean, I remember in the second season of Game of Thrones, you hardly saw the dragons. You know,
right.
They were small the entire time. As they got bigger, they needed more CGI, bigger budgets. Took away from the story.
Yeah, the Battle of Blackwater, you don't see on screen. You see, you see Tyrion sort of gives the speech. You know, those are brave men knocking on our walls. Let's go and kill them. And then it sort of cuts to the aftermath of the battle. And guess what? It's still effective.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's a great storytelling and the great placement and the way that they filmed it. And all things that you are a fan of, that is the perfect way to do it. They showed you how to do that in those first two seasons of the Game of Thrones. And then they started putting more money into it, bigger production, and the storyline went downhill.
What is your favorite Fast movie? This one?
Five. This one. And that's the reason why I recommended it, because it was silly, but not to the point of shaking your... okay. maybe you, shaking your head silly, like, I cannot watch this any longer. Like, the last Fast movie that I saw was The Fate of the Furious, it was called.
Okay.
It was Fast 8. And that was shaking my head silly. That's why I didn't see the ninth one.
Okay. But will you see the ninth one?
I'll see it. I'll catch it when it comes up on streaming. I refuse to pay to go see that. Because I knew that there was a space scene in there, and I cannot, in good conscience, give my money away to watch cars in space.
To bridge too far?
That's what it took. It took the nuclear submarine in the Arctic against cars for me to say, I can't, I'm done.
All right, so when you say that that is what, you know, you just can't, you're done. Oddly enough, in this movie, in Fast Five, that the character that represented I can't, I'm done to me is Hobbs. Am I alone in that? Obviously, he got his own movie.
Yeah, he's extremely popular as a character. And if without you even telling me, I guess he's too much of a superhero to you in this film?
He's a ridiculous caricature of a person. As soon as he steps off, and granted, he's The Rock. Number one, was The Rock kept in a sauna in between takes?
Sweats in every single take.
Because I get there in Rio, but there is a level of moisture coming out of his skin that made me concerned that maybe he had a virus of some kind.
He caught something down there. Yeah, he's the only one who did it, though. He needs to glisten. I don't. Maybe it was in his contract. I don't know.
But the fact that, you know, from the moment he gets off the plane on the airstrip down in Rio, and he's talking to the local Brazilian cop, and he ends their encounter with, "I need two things from you: a translator and for you to stay the fuck out of my way."
That's great.
That is the equivalent of cars in space for me.
Yes. Okay, I get it. I get it. What's worse, Jason, is that he becomes 10 times worse as a caricature, not even as a caricature in the next movies. All fun to me, but when you look back on it, it's like, really? Like there was one scene really fast. He was injured in the movie where Jason Statham is the main antagonist, and at the end, because he wasn't really in the movie all that much until the end, and he's in the hospital. He sees what's going on television in the city where he's at, has a broken arm, and he tells his daughter who's there with him, he goes, "Daddy's got to go to work." And from the inside of the cast, he moves his broken arm, quote unquote.
Oh my God.
And the cast breaks off. And he goes, and he's perfectly healthy, and he's out there, and he's carrying a huge machine gun and, you know, rocket blasters. It's a lot. It's fun, but it does get to you a little bit. When that's why this was the one that I wanted you to see, because I don't want you to see them to make you uncomfortable. I wanted you to have a good time watching it, but also be like, shake your head a little bit. And I think this one did that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, like, once you get past some of the logical inconsistencies and you just sort of accept what you're seeing, and you're like, all right, I'll just take it for what it is. If you let yourself go and then you get to the inventiveness of the vault scene,
right,
you're like, all right, I'm having a good time. And
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I didn't hate it by any stretch. And
right. You've seen far worse, I would imagine.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's not even a question. Like the whole idea is to sort of expose us to stuff that we wouldn't otherwise watch, which leads us from the awful dialogue at points in Fast Five to the infinite stretches of time in Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, where there is no dialogue. And very curious how you dealt with, I think it's like an 8-minute black and white scene of a cab driving through an unnamed Soviet town.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I had to take notes on this film. I was not entirely confident that I was going to remember everything that struck me. I'm not going to say that I did not things that I did not like, because while this was not a film that I even knew existed before you suggested it to me, it definitely is not a film that I would ever have gone out of my way to watch, if I was not challenged to do so. That being said, I'll tell you right off the bat that I enjoyed the film.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's not a movie that I will ever go see again. I will never turn it on again to see it. I think I've gotten what I need to get out of it. And that was the whole point of this. So let's go into it. Andrei Tarkovsky, 1972 Soviet science fiction art film. And that word art is very important, I think, because the way that he filmed this movie is very artistic. Broad strokes of one thing and then broad strokes of another. And that he kind of mishmashes it a little bit together in the beginning of this film, made it difficult for me in the first 30 minutes to see exactly what was going on. First shot of the film started at 3 minutes and 30 seconds. That means 3 minutes and 30 seconds of black and white credits. You know when the first word was spoken?
Let me know.
4 minutes later, exactly. The first sound that was not background sound was 4 minutes and 4 and 4 minutes exactly later.
Welcome.
Which is amazing to me.
Welcome to the world of Andrei Tarkovsky.
The main character in this, his name is Chris Kelvin, I guess short for Christoph, Soviet psychiatrist, psychotherapist.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that's what I got. You know, being tasked to, for spoiler alert, for those who don't know, Solaris is a planet that apparently only the Soviets know about. They have a space station of sorts that is either orbiting the planet or is just above the planet's surface. And the planet itself is all ocean. But I don't know what the point of that is that they're there, but they're trying to figure out if they need to be there any longer. And they send him over there because there are people that are on the space station. Apparently there were dozens of them at one point, but now there's only 3. And people who have either returned or messages coming back from them say makes it sound like something's happening. They're gibberish. The messages don't make sense. So they want to send somebody up there to see exactly what the hell's going on.
Exactly. So they send the main character, Chris mm-hmm. Kelvin. And mm-hmm. before he goes, you know, you sort of get a vibe that he is dissatisfied. He's existentially troubled. Mm-hmm. And that's a common right. that's a common theme with all of Tarkovsky's characters. I came to Solaris and I was toying with this or probably his more well-known film Stalker. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out which one you would latch on to more. And I ended up going with this one only because I thought the ending was a little more clear. I mean, obviously it's open to interpretation, but I thought the ending was a little more definite as opposed to the ending of Stalker, which is another movie you're probably going to watch in a future episode. But the thing with Solaris and the reason why I love Tarkovsky and a lot of like movie nerds and film, probably film nerds, movie nerds is, it would be insulting, is the fact that he doesn't explain anything. And he's
not a thing.
He's almost like David Lynch in that regard. Or oh, yeah. Nicholas Winding Refn, where it's all interpretive and it's all on, it's pretty much the opposite of the Fast movies where they are going to explain everything that's going on to the audience bit by bit. In this, Tarkovsky is actively challenging the audience to remain engaged.
But don't you also think that he, well, I took a lot of the first, a big part of this film from Kubrick, I thought.
Yes.
I saw a lot of 2001 in this film, which came out 3 years after 2001 was released, I believe.
Yes. So what I've read is this was Tarkovsky's response to Kubrick's very clean, very promising, very functional version of the future, where the ships are precise. All the settings in 2001 are immaculate. And Tarkovsky's approach was, we're going to show them what it would be. And I'm not a Tarkovsky scholar, so I don't want to speak for him. I don't know him well enough to sort of speak for him. But from what I've read, his approach was our version of space would be run down and broken.
Right. Okay. Now, and I wonder how much of that is I don't know Russian filmmakers, but it was done in 1972, and we're talking the height of communist Russia. I wonder if they viewed their worldview as broken down. This is a time in their lives where you needed a wheelbarrow of rubles to buy a loaf of bread.
Right.
So I can't imagine that life wasn't gray for many people in that country during the 70s, 60s and 70s. And maybe this is how he projects it onto film so people can see it.
Yeah, and I think, again, with the limited knowledge that I have of Tarkovsky, he eventually defected to the West in, I think, in the mid-80s or the early 80s. He shot one of his last movies in Italy with Russian approval, and then after that, he defected. So to say that it would not be impossible to say that he was felt constricted or disillusioned by the promise of communistic splendor.
I would imagine so. And I think he shows that in a lot of the shots that he does for so uncomfortably long. Within 10 minutes, just a few minutes after the first word is spoken, the main character, Chris, is standing in the rain, hands in his pockets, and looking at fruit and a coffee cup filling with rainwater. And while that was it's a nice shot cinematically, I don't need to see it for 30 seconds, 45 seconds. That's how long it was there for.
But I don't understand
long shots.
But you did need to see it. He did need to impress that upon you for the ending to have the effect that it had, hopefully.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. So we'll get into that. He accepts the trip that he has to take, that they are going to, I don't know how they get him over there, but onto the space station around Solaris. He accepts it. And basically the beginning of the movie, the first 15 minutes of where the heavy dialogue with his father is and his family, is just basically saying goodbye to his family and his life.
Yeah.
As we see that he is burning his achievements, everything that he's had his entire life on Earth. He's now basically ending it. And there is nothing more existential than literally destroying your own life while not taking it. You're just ending how you are known, what you are known for, who you are. And he's leaving. And I don't think he ever expected to go back.
Yeah. And I think obviously we know that his wife, Hari, is dead. And right. He's burning, like you said, symbolically, he's literally burning his life on Earth before he travels up to the space station. And I think there's the intention that he's never coming back. Before he goes, he sort of knows that he's never coming back.
Right. And that the last day with his father, he's upset that there's somebody there that is, that's kind of taking away from his last moments with his family. So he gets upset at that. And I found that to be telling of where the film was going. However, shortly after that, you get into what you mentioned earlier, that 33 minutes into the movie, there is a scene, and I'm not even saying a scene. It is just a long cut of being inside a car. You're in the point of view of the driver.
Yep.
And you're driving in black and white. What was once color before the 33-minute mark is now in black and white, and it gradually turns into color, and it's that you're only broken up for to see who's in the car sporadically.
Yeah.
But it lasted for an uncomfortable amount of I should have written it down. It was like, and I did not want to, I didn't fast forward it. I wanted to see if I missed any kind of dialogue. I wish there was dialogue. There was nothing. Okay, that's where the art comes into the film. I just don't understand it.
So,
I don't get it.
So with some of the directors that I'm into, David Lynch, Nicholas Winding Refn, I've mentioned those two, Tarkovsky, some of the French directors, Truffaut, Godard, there's a, and again, not a film scholar here, this is just what I've read, there's this sort of belief that film is more of an experiential experience. It's more emotional, and it's not a means of conveying information. So whereas a movie like Fast Five is saying, we have $100 million in a vault. We're going to steal the money out of the vault. Here's how we're going to do it. There's a belief that some of these films by these more auteur style art house directors are more concerned with making you feel something. And if they have to make you watch two characters go from point A to point B in a car for 4.5 minutes or 5 minutes or 7 minutes, whatever it might be, that's what they're going to do. And that feeling that it evokes is going to be different for everyone. And I, when I was younger, I used to not understand it. And I'm not sure I do now, but I'm, as I get older, I'm more willing to be taken for the ride.
And that's exactly what I think they were trying to do. They were insert you into the car where you are driving to the next destination, the next quote unquote point of the movie that is going to move it forward. And it was just felt draining to me for that amount of time.
Okay.
Honestly, I had to stop. Thankfully, you know, we're in the streaming era of movies where you can stop and walk away from it and then move back to it when you feel ready, because you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to watch 2.5 more hours of this.
So
that's,
you know,
how I felt. Yeah.
Maybe then that was effective in its way. And obviously this was made before the advent of streaming or even viewing at home. So most people,
can you imagine being in the theater?
In a theater.
Watching this?
I would have loved the opportunity.
Oh my God.
I would have loved it.
I can't imagine it. I don't know. It wouldn't have made me uncomfortable, but I would have been like, what am I? I would have gotten angry.
You would have questioned your life choices.
Viscerally angry. I would definitely have questioned that night's choice.
So for those of you kind of gave the lay of the land of the plot for what exists of the plot, but essentially this water that exists on the planet Solaris apparently is able to create the deepest feelings or the deepest desires of people on the space station.
Yes, I took it as it had sentient life of some sort, where it was able to, I don't know if you want to say contact or
maybe like read
I'm not sure if it was actually a defense mechanism either. I thought that there was something that the humans in the space station had done for the planet to sort of to reach out to them afterwards. There were plenty of people on that space station, and they said beforehand, and now there are only three. And then you saw what the entire station looked like. It was disheveled. It was broken. You know, looking at it, I wondered how it even stayed in orbit. So
is that a metaphor for Soviet Russia in 1973?
It's entirely possible, and I didn't think of that, but seeing as how we said earlier that this is how he maybe thought of communism, how bleak and destructive it is, it's entirely possible that everybody killed themselves up until except for those three last people that were on there.
And that's kind of the surface level reading, and that's what I go back to, and I'm sure that there's a much deeper, much more abstract meaning, because essentially Chris Kelvin is a character who's kind of has decided he has nothing to live for until Solaris creates a version of his dead wife and presents that to him.
Which at first he was horrified at seeing her, although he was kind of told ahead of time that whatever he sees, you know, that he should. His dead friend, Dr. Gabarian, who he is the only person he knows on there, he finds out that person had killed himself but left a video recording of himself and was telling him that, you know, accept whatever it is that he sees on the space station.
And
Dr. Snout,
yes,
the first professor that he meets on there, first doctor, is acting. You know, he looks like a little bit of a weasel, but he's acting in a way that's very mysterious. He's trying to. The guy just got there, and he's like, oh, you know, why don't you come back like in an hour? And clearly, there's somebody in the room with him, but he doesn't want him to see who it is.
Yeah.
And if there's only supposed to be three people on this entire space station, well, who is this other person that's there?
And another common theme in the Tarkovsky films I've seen is the acceptance of the characters, is the willingness of the characters to accept the world that they are presented with.
Yes. I thought it was very strange that this is happening to them, that they are presented with inhuman doppelgangers of people that they know, their fears, their hopes, their dreams, literally put in front of them. And they're like, okay, you know, cool.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they thought that this is their end. They're going to die. They might as well enjoy themselves. This is what happens with Chris, obviously. This is now his life becomes his quote unquote wife. Hottie, has she's presented to him by the planet. But I took it also as very strange that they were kind of okay with all this.
I think maybe it speaks to our willingness to accept a created reality as one that we can live with and live within, and not only just tolerate, but at some point choose, right? Because at the end of the movie, I'm curious, what is your interpretation of the end of the movie?
As we're talking about it, I start getting different interpretations because we didn't talk about this until today. I originally thought that he had pretty much given in to his, insanity, maybe his psychosis. He just is now living within the dream of whatever it is that Hottie is, whatever it is that the planet gave him. So while we see the last shot is of his home on Earth, is basically now an island in this vast ocean of the planet Solaris.
Yes.
And it may also have been just his mind. You know, let's just say he lost his mind entirely, and that's how he's now envisions the world around him, that he's on this one little island that is his home on the planet. That's how I took it.
Interesting. I hadn't really thought of it as more of that scene existing within his mind. I took it, again, I'm pretty literal in a lot of regards, even with the more right. avant-garde filmmakers. There's a lot more people. There's a lot of people more intelligent than me that are dissecting this kind of work effectively and intelligently. But I read it at that level of he chooses to remain in the created reality that the planet gives him. And that, like you said, he goes back. Mm-hmm. The last scene is him returning to his home, but there's water coming down everywhere.
Right, right.
And you realize as the camera pulls out that he's on the vast ocean of this planet. And essentially he has chosen to remain in that version of his father that is not quite his father, and that right. version of Hari.
He was saying to Snout, what should I do, while he was on the station towards the end of the film? Should I go back to Earth? Should I stay here? And you kind of got the sense that he was leaning on going back to Earth. And he does. However, does he do that in the literal sense where he's on an island in this vast ocean of the planet, or is it all in his mind? I lean towards the mind part because existentialism is a state of mind. And I don't know that it could be so literal when this film is so, so deep in existentialism and the thought of a person's worth and their life and where they are in their own worth in their own lives. Really, no other way for me to say it. So that's why I think it's more of a less literal than it is in his mind.
We each saw movies that we wouldn't have otherwise.
Right.
I don't know if there's a way. I don't want to I don't like ranking. I don't like assigning a very binary we liked or didn't like, or something was either good or bad, because I don't think anything is that simple. Are you glad you experienced this film?
Yeah, I'm definitely glad I experienced the film. I think that I got something out of this film. I the first existential film that I've seen in quite a long time, if ever. I've read The Stranger by Camus, and that was my introduction to existentialism when a long time ago. However, I don't think I've ever seen it on the screen presented to me like this was. So I'm glad I experienced it. Not something I'm going to go back to. Not something that I would look forward to seeing in the future, a type of film like this, unless I absolutely stumbled on it. And this is what we did. We stumbled on it. I wanted to point out a couple of things about the film, though. No music.
Yeah.
It took me a while to realize that, but once I did realize it, it was unnerving. And to your point that he wants you to experience things as they happen, well, our world is without music.
Yep.
I mean, when in my mind, I don't have music playing. I hear music from the outside, but unless it's on, you don't have it. So that's how we live through these characters. I was very uncomfortable with the long shots where and by long shots, I'm saying he's just the camera just staring at somebody or somebody's just staring back at the camera. And a long shot for me, if that's more than 3 seconds, you start thinking to yourself, okay, what are they doing? What did the camera stop? Is the film paused? And we're talking, that's happened a bunch of times for 10 to 20 to 30 seconds. Not comfortable with those at all.
Were you not comfortable with them because it forces you into questions? Because here's the thing, right? Is I've heard a saying that like great art asks questions. It doesn't provide answers. So when you're watching something, when you're watching a shot go on for like 90 seconds and no one's speaking, yeah, there's a scene in Stalker that goes on for, I think, over 5 minutes of just three men looking into a room, which is in the direction of the camera, and nothing happens. And
I couldn't handle that.
And part of that, I think, is because we're forced to sort of deal with our own thoughts on what we're seeing. And I feel like soundtracks, like music, like noise, the literal and metaphorical element of noise, be it actual sounds that we're hearing or music, or the noise that keeps out our deepest, most troubling questions that we don't want to ask ourselves, that we distract ourselves with music and video games and movies and all this other crap. Right. And when you're in a room, especially when you're in a movie theater, when this would have been seen, and there are no phones to distract us, and you're not talking to someone, and literally all you have is your interpretation of what you're seeing on the screen.
There's no Wikipedia to go to exactly. See what exactly the plot's about, right?
Exactly. And yep. You're forced to deal with your own interpretation of what you're seeing. And sometimes that can be disturbing.
I wholeheartedly agree.
The reason why I gave you Solaris instead of Stalker, which I'll give you Stalker in a future episode, but the reason why I gave you Solaris is the ending hit me personally in the gut.
Okay. I mean, I see that. I see that. I mean, but at the same time, that ending wasn't so much to me a sad ending. It was, if it was literal or within his mind, it's something that he chose.
Yeah.
The reason why he left the earth and burned his life in a literal sense was that he had nothing left to live for. His wife had been dead for 10 years, and we find out she killed herself after an argument that they had.
Yep.
So he obviously harbored guilt, and he chose at the very end to stay with the vision, the fake wife. At least he had her, and he was happy with that.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was terrible.
No, he's living in the echo of his own past.
Right, exactly. And he's happy with the decision he made. I wanted to go over one thing that I really enjoyed about the film, and it was a piece of dialogue, and it came from the Dr. Snout, who was talking about the fact that that man is out there in searching the cosmos for other life and other worlds, and he says that we don't know what to do with other worlds. We don't need other worlds. We need a mirror. We struggle for contact, but we will never find it. We're striving for a goal that he fears, that he has no need for. Man needs man. And I thought that was the entire part of the point of the movie, that showing that here we are, the space race had pretty much ended by 1969. And, you know, I'm sure that Russia was still doing things as we are. We're always looking for signs of life in the universe. But we don't need to. I feel we don't need to, because once we find that there's life in out there, it kind of makes us question ourselves. And, you know, I think that's often been a common theme in science fiction movies, that once we find life in other worlds, we are no longer alone and special. And we really only need ourselves. We don't need to find things out in space.
And yet, Chris, at the end of the movie, commits himself either psychologically or literally to that world, that sort of distant other world. Because
yes, absolutely.
Because ours has become for him too difficult to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't want to go back to what it was. He only wants what it is now.
I wish I could go back to a time before I saw Fast Five, but I cannot. And now I will always have Dominic Toretta's voice in my head.
Oh, yeah. Yes, you will.
All right. So we've watched Solaris and we watched Fast Five. Here's the question. Yeah. What are we watching next week? What's my challenge?
Okay, well, I've been thinking long and hard about this during the week, and I think that I'm going to get you started on the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Oh, dear God.
Yes, I know. I've been looking forward to this, but I really wanted to make it a challenge where it wasn't going to be all-encompassing. Obviously, there are 26 movies. You're not going to be watching them.
There are 26?
There are 26, I believe 26 as of now, with the last one that just came out, but with the Eternals. But we can't make this a Marvel Cinematic Universe review show, okay? There are plenty of them out there. This has to be something a little bit more in-depth. And I think that I'm going to give you the tentpoles of the movie, which is it's going to really be Avengers and the second Avengers movies and Civil War, the big ones.
Okay.
I don't really think that you are going to need to see the smaller movies that lead up to those.
No.
So I think that
Ant-Man 2?
No. I know that you're really looking forward to Ant-Man and Paul Rudd, my personal favorite. So I challenge you to watch 2012's Avengers movie.
Oh dear God! So that's the first one, right?
Yes, that's the first one, and it is the culmination of Phase 1, which started with Iron Man 1. The movies were Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, Thor, Captain America, and I apologize, but the second one actually was second movie.
Winter Soldier?
It was Incredible Hulk. So Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, which came out within a month of each other before they decided to make a universe out of this. Separate movie studios, by the way. So Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, Thor, and then Captain America, which led right into Avengers.
And that is my challenge.
Yes, Avengers 2012.
All right. I will watch Avengers 2012.
Very good. And my challenge will be?
Your challenge. I danced around giving you another foreign film, but I decided I'm going to give you something that doesn't require reading.
Thank God.
But it will be no less disturbing or haunting, I assure you. David Lynch's 1997 Lost Highway.
Ooh.
Starring Bill Pullman, Patricia Arquette, and Balthazar Getty.
Okay.
Have you watched any Lynch?
I've...
Besides Dune.
If I have, it was by accident. So not because I wanted to. I've known of Lynch for a long time. We've spoke of him in the past. He's very, for lack of a better word, out there,
yep,
avant-garde, and not the type of film that I would go out of my way, although I did hear good things about Lost Highway. So I challenge accepted.
All right, and I will watch Avengers. Challenge accepted. You will watch David Lynch's Lost Highway. And we'll be back next week to discuss these two movies and to talk about whatever we're going to keep on challenging each other with.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to your review.
All right. Everyone, thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Movie Challenge Accepted.